Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. You should always consult with an investment professional before making important investment decisions. Securities offered through J.W. Cole Financial, Inc., member FINRA, and SIPC. Investment advice offered through CFCI, an SEC-registered investment advisor. 674 South College Avenue, Bloomington, Indiana. Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Big Show, Your Money with David Hayes. Thanks for hanging out with me on this Thursday night. Of course, always on Saturday mornings as well, 9 o'clock sharp. We'll be back on the air. We have a great show today. Rodney Johnson, a good friend of the show, will be joining us in just a few minutes. Rodney, of course, is the researcher for Harry Dent, who, of course, has been on the news media over and over and over. And if you follow financial stuff and you Google or look up Harry Dent, you'll know he's a little bit of a gloom and doom guy. Well, Rodney is the common sense guy behind all of that. He's the senior editor of Boom and Bust and the Daily E-Letter and Economic and Markets newsletter that goes out. If you want to check him out, go to economyandmarkets.com. Rodney's going to join us in just a few minutes. Before we get to Rodney, we're going to take a second and talk about some of the news of the week brought to you by J&S Locksmith. J&S Locksmith, where you'll find everything for the residential or commercial outdoor technician. J&S at 508 West 17th Street in B-Town. Well, here it came. The S&P 500 erased all the losses for the year. U.S. stocks rallied on the fourth day, wiping out losses for the year, as the European Central Bank unveiled an expanded stimulus plan, and banks and transportation companies surged on better-than-expected earnings. This is not a big surprise, folks. We've been talking about it a long time. The ECB president, Mario, announced that the expanded asset purchase program, including some private securities, up to 60 billion euros, that's $690 billion a month. The buying will continue through September of 16. I would predict that will continue longer than that, and that this is just the start of something even bigger. The announcement came after the ECB benchmark rates were unchanged, still at record lows. A near stagnant economy, the risk of deflation forced their hand after it's been about 6 years now that the Federal Reserve took a similar step here in the U.S., gambled on the benefits that QE would actually benefit the economy, and the jury's still out, of course, on that. You know, actually talking about quantitative easing, and as the U.S. government, you know, bought bonds. The Fed actually had profits of $99 billion in 2014. That was then just returned to the Treasury Department. Borrow, earn interest, give the money back. Largely, again, from interest income on the $3.7 trillion of Treasury notes and bonds purchased during the first 6 years of QE that ended in October. Over the last six calendar years, the Fed has returned $469 billion to the Treasury Department, equal to about $78 billion a year. This comes from By the Numbers with our friend Mick Higley. Over the 18 years prior to QE, the Fed returned an average of $19 billion a year to the Treasury Department. You know, the U.S. economy is about 23% of the global economy. You know, the global economy is about $77.6 trillion. The Eurozone, we're going to be talking about that with Rodney in just a little bit, it represents 19 countries, and their total size is about $13.2 trillion. And finally, a slow start to Obama's MyRA retirement savings program. About a year ago, President Obama outlined a program designed to encourage workers to save for retirement, especially those that do not have a 401k-type plan through their employer. And at the 2014 State of the Union, he described the MyRA. Of course, that rhymes with IRA, but it stands for My Retirement Account, an account that would use simple, safe investments and allow workers to take it from job to job. Of course, the president said he wanted it up and running by the end of 2014. Well, the Treasury Department met the deadline just barely, and it launched a pilot program in mid-December. There was little publicity about it, and the agency won't say how many employers are participating or exactly when MyRAs will become more widely available this year. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll be joined live by Rodney Johnson from the Sunshine State. He's a senior editor of Boom and Bust, as well as the Daily E-Letter and of Economic and Markets. We'll be right back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Rodney Johnson joins me live on the telephone. He's a senior editor of Boom and Bust and of the Daily E-Letter, Economy and Markets. You can follow Rodney at economyandmarkets.com. And Rodney, you know, anytime the world seems to be turned upside down, I call on you guys to help explain it all. And here we sit at a very interesting time. There's no question about it. Today, just today on Thursday, the central banks, the European Central Bank announced a pretty heavy asset purchase program. No big surprise to people that pay attention to this kind of stuff. But I guess the end of the day, Rodney, is what is going on in the world right now?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because you say everybody expected the European Central Bank, the ECB, to come out with their own bond buying program called quantitative easing. But it's so monumental because they're fighting what's not going on in the world. And that's really the key. What they don't have in the economic bloc that shares the euro, these 19 countries, is growth.
Right.
They just don't have it. And what they do have is high unemployment. The unemployment for the overall area is 11.5%. 11.5%. And they're falling into deflation where prices are actually going negative month over month and now year over year. They actually were negative for the year of 2014. And so the European Central Bank is trying what the Federal Reserve did here in the United States and the Japanese have done in Japan. The problem is it hasn't worked in either of those places to make things grow. We did have liquidity in the United States when we started buying bonds back in 2009 when everybody was kind of frozen in fear for a few minutes. And that's what a central bank is supposed to do, add liquidity. But it didn't foment growth in any way. And that's the mistake that they're making over there. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Well, low interest rates, falling oil prices, central banks pouring money in all over the place. You know, you guys have been forecasting this, Rodney, for a long time. You've been forecasting, you know, don't bet against the dollar. You know, the world's going to be fighting, at least some of the major industrialized countries, fighting deflation, not inflation. And it seems like it's finally kind of unfolding right before our eyes, isn't it?
It really is. And you know, these things, it's like somebody in the Wall Street Journal wrote 5 or 6 years ago about something going on financial, that it's like a train wreck in slow motion. But it's still a train wreck. The fact that it's happening slowly doesn't make the impact any less. It just takes a long time to happen. And so that's what we've been watching in the Eurozone. And people shouldn't lose sight that, you know, just 22 years ago, or 23, I know it sounds like forever, but when the Euro got together, the Germans were very hesitant, said, we don't want to do this because we think one day someone will want to print money to get themselves out of an economic jam, and we don't want to be part of that because we remember what happened back in the 1920s when everything went terrible after that. And everybody said, no, 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 no. We'll never allow the Central Bank of Europe to print new euros to buy bonds. That'll never happen. And here we are.
Here we
23
are.
23 years later.
Now, Greece, I think, is wanting to get out of the euro and try to do their own thing. They're trying to vote in maybe someone who's not so hip on the bailout program that's been proposed and some of the austerity programs. So I don't know. Rodney, do you think the euro can withstand this mess, or is it doomed to fail?
It's going to withstand it in name, and that's kind of how we got to look at it. The vote is on this Sunday, so just a couple of days away here. The Greeks basically cast a vote of no confidence for the current group who have been putting in these austerity plans and raising taxes and cutting all the social programs. And they're saying, look, it's not working. We have over 50%, think about it, 50% youth unemployment in Greece. We are not going anywhere. And so this new guy says, look, I'm going to get rid of all that austerity because it's not working. He's hinting at not wanting to stay in the euro. But what's going to happen instead is he's going to ask the European Central Banks and other central banks to cut down the debt that Greece owes. And that's what they're going to do. They're going to come to some arrangement to where the Greeks don't owe as much money back, but they stay with the euro. Because it's better for them to not have the precedence of anyone leaving than it is to say, no, no, you have to pay us back everything. Because, frankly, if they left, they wouldn't pay them anyway.
Right, exactly. They're good. Yeah. Good point. Hey, as we talk about the bond market's been warning of trouble ahead for a while. I mean, the 30-year Treasury down under 3, the 10-year under 2. I mean, the 5-year's been hanging in there, I think, around 1.5 or so. And our central bank is planning on, and they seem to be sticking to their guns, to start raising rates. My question to you, Rodney, is have the central banks lost some relevance?
I think years ago, the central bank lost relevance. In terms of what they were doing was having the intended effect. When the central bank in the United States prints new dollars, and they use those dollars to buy bonds.
Mm-hmm.
They're necessarily pushing up the price of those bonds, which pushes down yields. And so they're having an effect, that's true, but that's not what they really wanted. What they really wanted was the lower yields to entice me and you and everyone listening to use borrowed money, because it's now cheaper with a lower interest rate, to go buy a bunch of stuff. And hopefully, when we go buy a bunch of stuff, that means businesses sell more, so they're putting more people to work, so there are more jobs, and then the train goes on and on and on. But it didn't happen. You and I didn't borrow more money. As a matter of fact, if you go look at the borrowing, consumer credit, we spent more on cars, no question about that, but the age of the fleet in the United States is still the oldest it's ever been, and we took on student loan debt. If you look at credit card debt, we're actually kind of flat. We're just not taking on a lot more, and certainly mortgage debt isn't what it was at the high. And so we're not taking on that credit to go spend like crazy that pushes the economy higher. And that's what the Fed wanted, and it just didn't work.
We're going to take a break, Rodney. When we come back, we're going to talk about people, which is one of your favorite topics. You are a good demographer, and as you talk about people like you and I do not want to go out and borrow money, we're going to talk about what the world is fighting, and that's a demographic trend, a slowdown in spending. People aren't going to take out debt and try to go do crazy things with it. And we want to talk about Japan. We want to talk about Europe, and we definitely want to talk about the U.S. We'll be right back, folks. Rodney Johnson is our guest. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. Your Money with David Hayes. Rodney Johnson's our guest, the senior editor of Boom and Bust and the daily e-letter, Economy and Markets. You can check out Rodney and follow him at economyandmarkets.com. And Rodney, before we went to the break, we talked about the idea of people and what people do. And in any major industrialized country, what people do and what they spend their money on is very, very important, isn't it?
It is, and you can see what people are going to buy by looking at how old they are. I mean, I don't know what any one person's going to buy, but I know in general that people who are in their 20s are going to get married, and they're going to buy some furniture, and then in the late 20s they're going to have babies, and they're going to buy all the stuff that goes with babies, and they're going to want a house. It happens around 28 to 30, 31, and then they're going to have another child, and they're going to be buying all those young child things, sports equipment and lessons and stuff, and probably a minivan. And then, of course, you get into your 40s, you buy a bigger home because you want those kids further away from you, or you want a game room where they're not going to bug you anymore. And then you might buy a motorcycle when you're 45, 46, and then the kids go off to college, and then you start saving for retirement. I mean, it's a progression. And like I said, I don't know what any one person's going to do, but I know what populations do. And if you can kind of follow these trends, then you can make some pretty good forecasts on where economies are going to go.
And you guys have been forecasting a lot of what's unveiling right in front of our eyes. But, Rodney, as we look at the importance of consumers, because in America, because in Europe, because in Japan, a good part of gross domestic product, of the growth, comes from consumer spending. So walk us through what happens to folks as they kind of enter their 50s, their kids get a little bit older. And what happens to their habits then?
Well, and what we typically do is, you know, we'll spend most everything we have to keep our standard of living with our children at a current rate or growing. I mean, we just will. That's what parents do. It's part of that protective thing. Once the kids get out of our household and kind of go on their merry way, hopefully, we kind of look up, and the goal is no longer the standard of living for all these people running through my home, eating everything and, you know, needing clothing and shelter and stuff. It's now about the next stage of life, which is going to be retirement. So in those empty nester years of the 50s, that's when we tend to really hunker down and start saving more. We're paying off debt, putting money in investments, and kind of getting serious about preparing for retirement. Doesn't mean we live badly. Doesn't mean we only eat, you know, rice and beans. But we tend to use cash or, you know, cash equivalent, pay off the credit card every month, versus taking on more debt. And you can see the boomers moving through our economy, and the highest number of boomers were born in 1961. These people are 54, 55 years old now. And so they're in those empty nester years, and they are just smack dab in the years where you worry about retirement. You're not worried about having 20-inch rims on a big Suburban anymore, or having the biggest house and throwing the biggest party. You're looking at 65 being a decade away and thinking, am I ready? And most people can't answer that.
Yeah, so you start spending less, saving more, and that's not expensive, right, Rodney, to the economy? And that's maybe some of the problems that add fuel to the fire over in Europe and maybe could be a problem here in the United States, because we see it in Japan, without a doubt.
Oh, yeah. It's not just not expansive. I mean, this is something that, you know, of course, you and I have talked about many times at our conferences, is it's not something you can change about people. If I came to you tomorrow and said, look, I'm going to make any money you spend free for the year. You just spend the money, and then you pay me off later in the year. You pay no interest, no nothing. You just consume all you want. I almost guarantee it's not going to change what you do at this point in your life. But if I told you, I'm going to take care of your financial needs when you're older, and here's an ironclad contract that you can guarantee that's going to happen, I bet you might spend a lot more.
Mm-hmm.
We're not doing the things to take away the financial worry that people have. Low interest rates doesn't do it. They're worried about something completely different.
Well, they thought if we would lower interest rates to zero, then why would you not borrow the money and go out and do something with it? Well, it has pushed people into investing in riskier assets. And, Rodney, is that the primary driver, in your opinion, why the stock market has done so well over the last few years? And, of course, that's been the bet in Europe, that if they start doing something similar to what we did, we might see the same effects in the European region stock markets. And, of course, I'm not so sure that that will happen, but I can tell you when wholesalers come through my office and vice presidents of mutual fund families walk through, Rodney, they're telling us that's the European put, as they're calling it. They're saying that right there is your bailout if you miss the U.S. rally. What's your opinion on that?
I think it's very hard to compare the two. And the reason is, in the United States of America, if the Federal Reserve wants to buy bonds, in the nitty-gritty world of what you actually push the button to buy, there's a very deep market of bonds that are backed by Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, which, of course, have a government guarantee on them. And there's trillions of dollars worth of United States Treasury bonds that they can go choose from.
Mm-hmm.
The market is very deep and easy. When the European Central Bank wants to buy bonds, they don't. What they're doing is telling each individual central bank in all the countries, because they all still have their own national central bank, they're telling them to buy bonds in their own market. And so it's a very weird game that's this concert between European Central Bank kind of controlling and then the Central Bank of Germany, the Central Bank of France, the Central Bank, not Greece, they didn't include them, but the Italians, the Portuguese, the Spaniards. It's weird. And so which market do you think is going to do okay? Which market's going to get pushed? Which one of them won't really respond? It's just, it's crazy. And by the way, they're even older in population than we are. Particularly the Germans. People don't think about it, but it's a very old population. And so telling me that they're going to spend or they're going to change their habits because of low interest rates, I don't buy it.
You know, when you look at the U.S. real quick, Rodney, you look at Japan, you look at Europe, you know, not a lot of folks migrating to those, or immigration isn't big there. I mean, they're, as you've said before, their doors really don't swing in, are still due. Is that somewhat our bailout here to our demographic trends? Because, you know, I have one child. I did not do my part. I apologize, everyone. Rodney, you have two.
I have three.
Oh, three. Good. Thank you very much. I forgot.
Yeah, I made up for you.
Thank you very much. But I think we need about 2.1, if I'm not mistaken. So we need people to have babies. We need to continue this. And I remember even back when Russia identified, they had a major problem on their hands. And so is China. So they all know this. Russia, but was it back in 1998 or something that Putin announced that they had a family day where everyone wanted to take off and try to go home and make babies?
Yep, it was actually the mid-2000s. He declared kind of a day of love, and it was in September, hoping that he would have a number of babies born on, I think it's June 1st or June 8th, this Russia Day. And they still do it. It doesn't work, of course. The Russian population continues to decline, as does the Japanese population, and the South Koreans are pretty close. Because it just proves that you can't really change what people are going to do in their family formation. It doesn't work that way. And as you mentioned at the beginning of this, we're very dependent on migration, or immigration, not migration, but immigration for our population growth. We need people coming here who want to put down roots, want to stay here and have children here. That's what's been causing our growth to continue. If you looked at just the domestic population, people have been here two, three generations, we're not having enough children by far to keep the population even at its current level. we definitely depend on the immigrants.
Well, you have three kids because you live in sunny Florida, and people feel better in Florida than they
do. I can send them outside a lot. You can't do that.
That's exactly right. We're going to take another break with Rodney Johnson. He's going to hang in there. Rodney, when we come back, I want to talk about what everyone's been talking about. You can't open the newspaper. You can't look at Yahoo Finance without folks talking about oil. You know, how low can it go, and how will this really affect the world economies, the U.S. economy? I also want to talk about what the Swiss did to their currency, and why did it send such a big shockwave through the financial system when they did it? Maybe we'll talk about China a little bit. A lot to talk about. Rodney Johnson, one of the smartest guys I know, senior editor of Boom and Bust. We'll be right back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. Welcome back, everyone. You know, if you've been listening to the show and you're like, hey, I kind of like this guy, I like the way he thinks, go to economyandmarkets.com. Rodney Johnson, he's a senior editor of Boom and Bust. And Rodney, I think the next big conference opportunity where we'll be able to see each other is in Vancouver, if I read that correctly. Is that right?
It is. September 9th through 12th, we'll be in Vancouver, and it is a fabulous time to be up there.
I think I'm going to try to make that. I don't see why I can't. And what's Harry been up to, Harry Dent, these days? I haven't heard a lot from him, but every once in a while, if something will pop up. I'll see him on the national news media, but it seems like that you guys have him all over the world.
He's been ranting and raving. Yesterday, he was in D.C. area. He was shooting a video with David Stockman where they were kind of laying out their views of where we are and where things are going, and that should make its way around the internet here shortly.
Well, and that's usually the time where I get my phone calls. You know, that's why I like having you on, even though I love having Harry on, and he's entertaining and, like you said, ranting and raving and crazy, but it makes my phone ring the next morning.
I'd imagine, yeah.
And I'm like, okay, guys, we're going to settle this down just a little bit. So Rodney Johnson, the more rational of the two, is on the show. And Rodney, I don't think anyone could have predicted that oil prices would have gone from $105 down to $47 a barrel. And I guess the first question is, everyone speculates why it's happening. You can blame strengthening dollar. You can blame slow growth in the world, oversupply, whatever it might be. What do you see, and maybe it's all three of those things, as the reason that oil is dropping and had been dropping so rapidly?
Well, we'll get rid of the dollar question first. I mean, the price of oil can go down some because the dollar gets stronger. But, I mean, if you looked at it as a percentage change, the dollar increased in value versus the euro by, you know, 16-17%, but the price of oil fell by 60. So that they don't match up. What we're seeing is considered changes in the estimate of what people are going to use over the next several years, where it is the lower demand forecast, and something we've been talking about in oil for a long time, where we felt it was going to drop and could go as low as the mid-30s. But we've been talking about the world economy is not growing, and so that use estimate was wrong, which is, of course, why central banks are making all these changes. But on the other side, you have persistent increases in supply. And that was, it's really hard to get your arms around why people would do that. But we're adding a lot of supply into the market in the United States with fracking. Well, guess what? The Iraqis are adding a lot of supply because that's how they get money. They were, you know, producing the most they ever had. And you have the Venezuelans who want to sell it. You have the Iranians who need to sell it. The economies that are based on oil, the Russians, the Iranians, the Iraqis, the Saudis, Venezuelans, they don't have a choice. If the price goes down, they can't say, you know what, I'm going to hold some off the market until the prices come back, and I'm just going to kind of be judicious with this. They have to sell even more because the price is lower. And so you have this persistent increase in supply that really doesn't show any signs of abating anytime soon. And so it's really causing problems throughout the oil patch.
Yeah, it's either they get zero or $40. You know, which one is better?
Exactly. And I'll tell you what, this is going to show up, and it's something we've been looking at internally, and we're going to start putting some research out on it, is people aren't paying attention that the most economic growth we had in the United States over the last 7 years was in the oil patch, Texas, North Dakota, Colorado, Pennsylvania. If you take out the gains in employment in just Texas from the United States since the recovery started, so to speak, 2009, we still have fewer jobs than when the recession started. It's that much of an effect on the economy. Same goes for housing starts. It's in these states that have just tremendous money flowing from oil. And when that slows down, you're going to start seeing it hit housing, and you're going to see it hit employment.
Yeah, I think I was reading something recently about that, and it was pretty compelling. Those American workers, I think I saw it in Mick Higley's By the Numbers. I'm sure you read that like you read. I think you read about 10 papers a day.
I read a lot.
If I remember right. Plus, on top of that, you write an e-letter every day, The Economy and Markets. I get it. I enjoy it a lot. And the senior editor, of course, of Boom and Bust. And Rodney, as we talk about oil prices just briefly here, everyone keeps saying, well, it's great because I'm paying $1.80 at the pump. And that is great. It makes me feel good. What used to cost $50 to fill up my tank is now $25. But as the world goes, there has to be kind of the sweet spot in price. And to me, it seems like it's probably around $60 where there's harmony in the world. But this isn't going to happen, is it?
No, we really don't get it like that. The Saudis played this game in the 70s and the early 80s and lost, where
right.
they held supply back from the market and thinking the price would come back up. And what happened is their competitors just filled the gap and took the market share. And so the Saudis are like, to heck with it. We're going all in here. We're going to keep pumping. And so what's going to happen is you're going to start having bankruptcies of oil companies. The shale ones first here in the United States, of course. And as they stop flowing oil, you're going to see the supply slow down. And that's when prices come back. But you look at the oil-producing nations in the Middle East, they need oil over $100 a barrel to balance their budget. They make a profit over 10 or 15 bucks,
mm-hmm.
but they base their budget on $100 oil. And so they're going to do their best to really hurt the other producers of oil so that when it does come back, it'll stay much higher than 50 or 60 bucks.
Yeah, there was a good article in the Wall Street Journal, I think it was on the 14th of January, about Back to the Future, Oil
mm-hmm.
Replays 1980s. I'm sure you read that, but it's a pretty pretty cool article to read through, and it gives you a lot of perspective of why the Saudis are doing what they're doing today, because they didn't want to repeat some of the mistakes of the past. Hey, let's talk currencies for a second. You know, the Swiss, I don't really pay attention to this stuff, but until it happens, you know, all of a sudden the Swiss do something with their currency, the markets go crazy, everyone's kind of in shock. I mean, what did the Swiss do, Rodney, to their currency, or not do, that caused such a shockwave through the system for that 2 or 3 days?
Well, if you go back to 2007, 2008, 1 euro would buy 1.6 Swiss francs. And so that was a pretty good exchange rate for everybody in terms of trade. Over the years, from 2008 to 2011, the euro got weaker versus the Swiss franc because everybody said, those Swiss people, they're pretty good at banking. They got
mm-hmm.
a lot of gold. And so it fell to where the euro would only buy 1.2 Swiss francs. And the Swiss said, wait a second. Our currency is so expensive, the Europeans can't buy as much of our stuff anymore. And so they said if it got any stronger, if it fell down to, say, 1-to-1, then their exports of chocolates, which they do a lot, but also watches and all sorts of precision machinery would slow down and their economy would slow down. So the Swiss National Bank said, we're going to hold the level of 1 euro buys 1.2 Swiss francs. And so if it ever tries to go lower than that, we're going to print new Swiss francs out of thin air, and we're going to use it to buy euros. So we take euros off the market, and we put Swiss francs out there. And that's going to push it back to where we want it to be, 1 euro to 1.2 Swiss francs. They did it for 3.5 years. And coming into this quantitative easing that the ECB was going to do,
mm-hmm.
the Swiss said, we just can't do it anymore. We think it would take such an overwhelming number of Swiss francs to keep this going that it would just wreak havoc. And so what they did is surprised everyone. They didn't tell anybody they were going to do it. They stopped defending that level of 1.2-to-1. And when they did, it immediately fell to where the euro only bought 88 cents worth of a Swiss franc. It was a tremendous move that night. And it finally settled to where it was just over 1-to-1. But what it meant is this currency had moved 30% at one point and then really settled at 15-16. For people listening, I know that 30%, 15%, they don't seem all that much. But in the currency world, it's like moving mountains. And so people make very large bets on currency, and a lot of them were wiped out overnight. And we're just now starting to hear about these hedge funds and these different investment vehicles that were literally just wiped out to zero overnight. I mean, in firms that were allowing people to trade on margin, wiped out overnight.
I think people, too, Rodney, have a hard time understanding what happens when a currency is strong and what happens when a currency is weak. And I've always just made it real simple and to folks and said, hey, when you have a strong currency, think of like a strong military, you go overseas. And when you have a weak currency. You kind of have a weak military. You kind of stay at home. Can you do a better job of maybe explaining how weak currencies and strong currencies affect things?
Well, I don't know if I can do better than that, but an analogy that might work for people is you can think of it as, you know, the 50-yard line in football. My $1 buys your one Canadian dollar. Call it a Canadian dollar. Well, if the Canadian dollar gets stronger, then you can buy more of my territory. And so the ball kind of moves onto my side, and I've got less and less land. But if the dollar gets stronger than the Canadian loonie, then I can go into their territory. I can get more of their stuff. And it's really all about stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because if my currency is strong, I can buy more stuff produced out of Europe. But they can't buy mine.
Right.
And so my producers, my workers may not be able to make as much, and so my economy might slow down. But if their economy is strong, they can buy more of my stuff, but then again, I can't buy as much of theirs. And so it's kind of this game of where everybody finds a balance.
I know what you've been talking about and forecasting this slowdown in China for a long, long time. We're seeing that right in front of our eyes again. You mentioned pegged currencies. They've had their currency pegged forever and kind of let it float a little bit. What's the forecast that your guys are giving China right now?
We've got the same one. We think China's in slowdown mode, and they certainly are. They have pumped stimulus into their markets two or three times in the past, really, 45 days. And what they're trying to manage is what's called a soft landing. They know that they have a slowdown going on in their property markets. They know they have a slowdown going on in their export markets. They're just trying to make it to where the slowdown doesn't hurt very much. The problem with soft landings is nobody can do it. I mean, we've just never seen it happen in the world. Usually it's kind of that splatter thing where they hit and just boom. And so we think the same thing is going to happen to the Chinese at some point where they basically have a very hard landing and their banking system has a shock. It won't go to zero. They don't fall to nothing. I mean, the Chinese have $1.3 trillion in reserve currency, or foreign reserves. And so they've got a lot of money where they can weather the storm, but they're going to have a storm.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to put axe to root. We're going to not put Rodney on the spot because we don't like to predict where we think the markets are going. But I think what we want to do is you can listen to the show and say, wow, I mean, this is a lot of information. There's a lot of moving parts here. When it comes down to it, my job as an investment advisor, as a financial planner, as a fiduciary, is to help people to not lose too much money when things are bad and to make decent money when things are good. So when we come back, we're going to ask Rodney his opinion. How do we make money in this market? Or how do we keep from losing it in the situation that we're in? We'll be right back. Final segment with Rodney Johnson. This is Your Money with David Hayes. All right, everyone, welcome back. Rodney Johnson. We have him just for a couple more minutes. He's a senior editor of Boom and Bust in the Daily E-Letter, Economy and Market. And of course, you can check out their stuff at economyandmarkets.com. And if you forget that, just email me at cfci.us, as you know how to do, and we will put you in touch with Rodney's group. Now, Rodney, we've been through a lot during the show. We've been through demographic trends. We've talked about slowdown in spending. We've talked about low interest rates, falling oil prices, currencies. We've talked about a lot. The real question, to put axe to root, as we say here in southern Indiana, how do people make sense of all this? How do we make money in a market like this? How do we keep people from losing money in situations that we're in? Give us a little bit of advice, Rodney.
Well, I'll tell you what we tell people in our Boom and Bust letter and what I'm sure you tell people as well, which is you make your investments based on some pretty good research of who you think is going to do well based on the demographics. I mean, what areas of the economy, what industries are serving people who are a growing part? And then once you've identified those, which is easier than it sounds when you're looking at the baby boomers and asking yourself, what do they buy, what do they do? You can then start looking around for companies or even industries if you want to do it more broadly, and that's where you invest. And then you pay attention. I mean, the hard part about what's going on right now is there's so many moving parts that I don't think anybody would be surprised to see the market roll over, you know, 15-20% over the next 6 months at some point, because frankly, we're kind of due for something like that. And we're past the point where in the 90s you just kind of put money at it and let it go and it's going to be okay. We really need to pay closer attention. And so as we've told people, make sure that you know why you're getting into something and make sure you have a plan for getting out.
Well, I think people too, Rodney, last year confused people. I mean, if you looked at the S&P 500, it was up 13%. It's the only thing that's on the news every day. They get their statements in the mail, and they say, well, I'm only up 6%. Well, but did you know that the real estate sector was up like 30? Did you know utility sector was up big? But did you know the commodity sector was down 30? Did you know that this sector was flat?
Exactly.
Did you, and the combination of all of that, I think, is where most people would be at 5, 6, 7% in a well-diversified portfolio. But the news media reports those three things, the Dow, the S&P. I mean, they usually flash up the 10-year, which no one even knows what that is for the most part. So, I mean, I think just giving people some understanding of, yeah, where should they be? How should they put things into perspective? Don't go beat up your advisor over the head because you only made 6% in a 13% market because he had you well-diversified.
Well, and understand, like you say, that hides the incredible dispersion, as it's called, among the returns in the different areas. Would you have wanted to hold oil through the end of last year? Well, you know, there's some oil in the S&P 500.
Mm-hmm.
You know, did you want to get hammered on, you know, some of the grains? And so did you expect interest rates to fall as dramatically as they did? And people have to think about that for a minute. When you say we're at lows in interest rates, we're at historical lows, lower than during the Depression, lower than during World War II, lower than during the financial crisis. Our long bond, as it's called, reached the lowest point in history because we saw less growth.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. And that's one of those things that's just astounding when you think about it. So I tell people, don't go crazy. Don't get out of the U.S. dollar. Don't go chasing emerging markets. Wait for more pain in commodities. Keep your money here at home in the U.S., and I think you'll be okay.
Rodney Johnson's been our guest. Rodney, I sure hope I can make the trip to Vancouver first. I've never been there. And I hear from you, it's a lovely place in September, and I do enjoy a great deal getting your information. I don't get to read it all because it's a lot, but I look at the headlines, I read a little bit, and I'll print them off, and I keep them at home, and if the Colts are playing, and they're playing like they did last week, I actually read them during the Colts game, which is what I did last week. Rodney, I appreciate you so much for taking the time, and again, anything I can do for you, you please let me know.
Thank you, David. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you, sir. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to kind of wrap up the show. You know, last week was my birthday. Did you guys know that? I was born January 16th of 1970. You know, for a long time, that makes me 45, by the way. For a long time, as a young person in this business, you know, you wanted to be a little older than what you really were. So I'm like, man, if I would have only been born 16, 17 days earlier, I could have said I was born in 1969. That sounds a heck of a lot older. The 1970, right? Well, now, as a 45-year-old guy, I'm thinking, born in 70? That sounds pretty cool. I was born in the 70s. I wasn't born in the 60s. I was born in the 70s because you want to sound a little bit younger. I'm kind of at that pivotal point right now. When we come back, someone sent me a birthday financial review in the mail. It was so, I loved it so much that I bought the subscription so I could start giving it to people. I have a client and a good friend, Charlie Parker, that turned 90 years old. I think it was a week ago, and I went in and printed one of these off for Charlie. I'm going to take it to his open house on Sunday afternoon, and it's pretty astounding, as a 90-year-old goes, of what was the cost of a gallon of milk, what was the cost of a loaf of bread or a car. I mean, did they even exist back then, Charlie? A new house, or where the Dow was. When we come back, I'm going to go through some of the financial reviews of my birthday year of 1970, January 16th. President Richard Nixon. Huh, lot here to talk about. We'll be back. This is Your Money with David Hayes. You know, I had an opportunity this week to go to Bloomington South and speak to the young entrepreneur class. The teacher asked me to come and just kind of talk about how I got started in my business and a little bit about our journey, and it was really fun. But one of the things that I thought about as I was talking about, you know, being an entrepreneur is how lucky am I? How lucky am I? Rodney talked about this during the show, demographics. You know, I'm in the retirement income planning business, the investment business. You guys know that. But I had a passion about this early on in life. I wanted to be a football coach and a math teacher. And fortunately, my football coach at the time said, don't do that. Do something different. So I did. And I'm glad I did. I learned a lot about personal finance. I learned a lot about investments, insurance, all the stuff that you know you need to know. But just had a real passion about it. But I did not know at that time when I was 22, 23 years old when I first started my company that at 45 years old, 21 years in the business, that 10,000 people a day in America would be turning 65. So I had this natural market, I guess, of people to help, and I just really was fortunate. So being that I was 45 on Friday, and that means my brother Dan told me, he said, no, you'll be 50 before you know it. I was a huge Vikings fan back then, my Minnesota Vikings fan. Minnesota went to 4 Super Bowls in a row, did not win a single one. In January of 1970, it was Super Bowl IV. The Kansas City Chiefs of the American Football League beat my Vikings of the NFL 23-7. That year, Pete Maravich broke the collegiate scoring record. And on January 16, 1970, Colonel Gaddafi became the president of Libya, if you can believe that. I didn't know that until I got this. You know, back in 1970, a lot of popular songs. Of course, number one, ABC, performed by the Jackson 5. Who doesn't still love that? Neil Diamond was cracking the top charts, but the Jackson 5 was big. The Academy Award-winning shows, Patton, directed by Franklin Schaffner, won Best Movie back then in 1970. Best Actor went to George C. Scott. I mean, this shows how old I'm. I'm actually getting old by, you know, when you compare this. But from a financial perspective, 1970, a gallon of milk, $1.32. Today, $3.76. Oh, I can get that. A loaf of bread, about a quarter. Now it's $1.41. A new car. The average new car in 1970 was $2,500. Today, $26,790. Now, I have a 1970 Chevy pickup that was my father-in-law's. He bought it brand new in 1970. We had it somewhat restored. I drive it around town. You might see it. They wrote an article about it in the HT once. And I looked up and found the slip. He bought it from Curry, and he paid just about this, $2,500 for that car, for that truck. Gallon of gas, 40 cents. In 2015, of course, we know it's about $2, but it's been at $4, whatever. The new house, a new house averaged in the United States in 1970, 40 grand. You can't even buy a double wide for that now, folks. It is about $210,000 today. Here's the thing. The Dow Jones Industrial Average in 1970, it was 838 points. Now, almost 18,000. Pretty amazing stuff. Race car driver A.J. Foyt, he was big back then, of course, and just Mario Andretti, all those guys. Just a lot of fun facts. So I subscribe to this. I think it's pretty cool. So when I know people that hit monumental birthdays, I'm not sure 45 is one of them, but I'm going to print this off and give it to them because I think it's pretty cool. Hey, if you are a school teacher or a school employee, any school employee, anywhere around the state, Wayne Thacker, Ryan Belcher from our office are doing a program for you Thursday, March 5th at Owen County State Bank over in Spencer. If you want to know more about that, email us at cfci.us and we'll connect you with those guys and get you registered. All right, so I hope everyone has a great night. Indiana basketball tonight, Maryland, 9 o'clock. It's going to be a great game, I hope. I gave up my tickets because I'm too lazy to stay up that late. Saturday morning show again, 9 o'clock in the morning. We'll talk to you again next week, everyone. Goodbye. Discussions in this show should not be construed as specific recommendations or investment advice. Guest opinions on this show do not necessarily represent those of the radio station, David Hayes, or CFCI. You should always consult with an investment professional before making important investment decisions. Investment advice offered through CFCI, an SEC registered investment advisor, 674 South College Avenue, Bloomington, Indiana.